Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' administration gets a report card on its first 100 days in office.
He has announced a series of environmental policies.
Also making an announcement no Florida governor ever has before.
Also tonight, a plan to scrap hospital regulations is headed to the Senate floor, but not without drastic changes.
I don't have a lot of heartburn with most of the policy, but I just have to say the process stinks to high end.
We'll also get an update on a number of bills that children's advocates hope make it through the lawmaking process, and we'll talk to the state's chief financial officer about a measure to help firefighters who are diagnosed with cancer. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's the end of week 7 in this year's Florida lawmaking session, just 2 weeks to go, and this is Capitol Report. Governor Ron DeSantis has reached his 100 days in office, and for the most part, he's getting good marks from the public. The new governor promised sweeping changes in the way the state addresses the environment, education, and, as Lynn Hatter reports, some of those promises require state lawmakers to back him up.
Tonight, Florida's 46th governor is on the job.
To mark the moment, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis released a 3-minute video on YouTube.
Pressing his Democratic opponents. Now in his first week, he has announced a series of environmental policies.
Also making an announcement no Florida governor ever has before. The state's first chief science officer.
DeSantis has been busy during his first 100 days on the job. He appointed a chief science officer, Thomas Frazier of the University of Florida. And that signals just one of many breaks with his predecessor, Rick Scott. DeSantis has made sweeping changes to the South Florida Water Management District, forcing Scott appointees out and putting his own people on that board in a move that has gotten bipartisan praise. And DeSantis is on his way to securing a campaign promise. The legislature is poised to grant his request for a $600 million investment in water quality.
We are recommending over 4 years, $2.5 billion for water resources and Everglades projects.
This is for the future of the state because the water really is the lifeblood of so much.
One of DeSantis's early moves was to pardon 4 men wrongfully convicted of raping a woman in Lake County in 1949. They came to be known as the Groveland Four. Advocates had been urging the state to pardon the men for years, but former Governor Scott refused. DeSantis and the state's new cabinet, however, did.
Approved pardons for all 4 men. It is never too late to do the right thing.
DeSantis has also made some controversial moves.
We do need to pass legislation in Florida to prevent sanctuary jurisdictions and sanctuary cities.
By successfully petitioning for
state lawmakers are warring over the issue now as efforts to do just that continue advancing in the state house. Immigration advocates are crying foul and calling the move discriminatory. DeSantis is also backing an expansion of the state's corporate tax scholarship program, which provides money to families who want to send their kids to private schools. And when the Florida Supreme Court ruled former Governor Rick Scott did not have the power to make new appointments to its bench before his term ended, DeSantis got the opportunity. Those appointments tilted the state's once liberal-leaning court to the other side and have been met by cheers from Republicans and worry from Democrats.
And appointing 3 spectacular justices to our state Supreme Court.
In March, the Quinnipiac Polling Institute released a survey on the governor's job performance. DeSantis got the highest marks given to the top executive in a decade, with Democrats backing the Republican governor 42% to 28%. I'm Lynn Hatter.
The Florida Senate is moving forward with a Certificate of Need repeal, but some call the move a dramatic shift that reneges on weeks of work. Sean Mulcahy reports the plan to scrap hospital regulations points to a bigger picture about the legislative process.
Certificate of Need regulations require hospitals and nursing homes to get state approval before opening new locations or expanding services. It's intended to keep healthcare facilities from flooding the market. But Republican lawmakers have chipped away at Certificate of Need for years. They argue opening up the market will bring down costs. And House Speaker Jose Oliva has made full repeal a top priority. Oliva addressed this in his opening remarks of the legislative session.
That is why we must get rid of policies like the Certificate of Need, which have only served to create local and regional monopolies.
The Senate, however, has not been as eager. Lawmakers spent weeks carefully crafting legislation, trying to ease the impact for hospitals that would potentially face more competition. The measure would have only applied to hospitals, not specialty health care centers, and new hospitals would be forced to accept Medicaid and Medicare, have at least 100 beds in addition to the emergency room, and provide charity care. But an amendment in the Appropriations Committee brings the Senate language much closer to the House's. It fully repeals Certificate of Need in 2 years, and it scraps provisions like the Medicaid and Medicare requirements. Here's Stewart Republican Senator Gail Harrell, the bill's sponsor.
This is much more similar to the House proposal. And although we do have very specific delays in implementation, theirs is a total out-and-out repeal of CON.
The flip-flop left many lawmakers on the committee stunned. Here's Fernandina Beach Republican Senator Aaron Bean.
You've taken all that work and all the protections, all of the nuances that we worked hard to craft, that gentle balance of a bill that was, I thought, a very positive bill, and we have really just thrown that away. So my first question is, what happened?
Harrell sidestepped questions as she pushed through the measure that would make sweeping changes to the state's healthcare system.
This is the direction we're going now. I think the 2 years gives us the ability to be very, very thoughtful in how we move forward.
That left the panel divided. Some, like Fleming Island Republican Senator Rob Bradley, welcomed the changes. Bradley says current law restricts healthcare access.
There's an entity that wants to build a hospital literally a mile from my house. And because the laws being what they are and their competition litigating it and arguing against it, that hospital is not going to be built.
Meanwhile, Brandon Republican Senator Tom Lee, who voted for the bill, lambasted his colleagues for making what he calls a mockery of the entire committee process.
Yeah, and I tell you, I apologize to people who might be surprised I voted for that amendment, but I knew it was going to pass. I knew this committee had been worked, and I knew that the votes were there.
The shift may be a bargaining chip. Senate President Bill Galvano is championing a major infrastructure package. That effort has struggled to pick up momentum in the House. Here's Lee again.
I don't have a lot of heartburn with most of the policy, some of it I don't understand. But I just have to say the process stinks to high heaven.
Harrell dodged the implications, but offered little explanation for the new language. She admits she doesn't know how the bill will affect the industry, but she wants the legislature's research agency to conduct a study. Bean says he knows what'll happen. He thinks smaller specialty hospitals will profit at the expense of rural and inner-city hospitals that provide the bulk of charity care.
Your previous bill protected them. Your previous bill protected taxpayers from having a hospital all in every neighborhood that fills up with Medicaid patients that we are on the hook for.
The measure is now ready for a floor vote. The House version has already been approved. I'm Sean Mulcahy.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Hurricane Michael gets a scary after-the-fact upgrade.
Continued to not only intensify, but rapidly so, in spite of the fact that there were certain factors that would normally work against them.
Children's advocates are hoping some bills supportive of their issues will succeed before the end of session, one of which would boost the requirements for early childhood teachers.
A lot of times in the state of Florida, you have a 16-year-old with a GED teaching, which really isn't teaching because they've not been given the proper education to be able to do that.
Last year's Parkland tragedy prompts Florida lawmakers to speed up the process when someone dials 911.
Kids weren't communicated with in this tragedy, and one of the biggest lapses, I think.
And a bill that would provide financial relief for firefighters who are diagnosed with cancer as a result of their job is moving full steam ahead.
it helps people realize that this is a profession they can go in that is going to give them peace of mind, that the profession is going to protect them.
Support for Capital Report is provided by The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
Hurricane Michael, the most powerful storm ever to make landfall in North Florida, has been reclassified by the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration as a Category 5. Ryan Daly spoke with Mark Wool, warning coordination meteorologist with NOAA in Tallahassee, about what went into putting the storm among the ranks of history's most destructive hurricanes.
Obviously, the categorization was changed retroactively. What goes into that as far as research, as the determinations that are made after the fact?
Well, they generally assign one of the PhDs down there, one of the hurricane specialists, to lead the effort to do an official reanalysis of these tropical systems after landfall. And it usually takes several months. So the timing of this report is nothing that very unusual. So what they'll do is they'll look at all sorts of data from aircraft measurements, from surface observations, satellite estimates, radar, wind speed estimates, and all of that, run through calculations and compare it all against one another to try to get the best estimate from multiple sources of what the winds actually were. And this is something that's very difficult to do in real time. So the increase was relatively minor, from 135 knots to 140 knots, or 160 miles an hour. That's typically they'll make adjustments somewhere within 10% up or down. So the size of the adjustment was small, but it was enough to tick it upward into the next category on the Saffir-Simpson hurricane wind scale.
And I understand it was even real time, as you said, it was right on the cusp.
It was.
Does on-the-ground damage get factored into that as well, on top of data?
They definitely had plenty of damage photos to look at. We collected over 1,700 damage point photos just here in the local office alone. So they had plenty to look at, but no. The answer to your question is no. This was based on a pure wind analysis. The real-time estimate at landfall on the official advisory was 155 miles an hour. So now they're saying 160. So it's the borderline for Cat 5 is 157. So we were right there anyway. And the difference in damage you'd get from a high-end Cat 4 versus low-end Cat 5 is minimal.
I understand this is one of a very small group of Category 5s that have impacted various places in the U.S.
That is correct. This is only the fourth one, fourth Category 5 hurricane to make a U.S. landfall. There's the Florida Keys hurricane in 1935, Hurricane Camille in 1969, came up into Mississippi, Hurricane Andrew, which was down in South Florida in 1992, and now Michael here in the Panhandle.
One of the particularly unsavory characteristics of Hurricane Michael was how fast it developed. Relative to some of those other hurricanes, and I know you're going back years and decades for some of them, was it kind of an outlier in that way?
It's really going to be hard for me to say, because I don't have at my fingertips, you know, the evolution of like the 1935 storm, for example, or even Camille. But I do know that some hurricanes like Florence, which was another big headline hurricane last year, that one was out there for 10 days before it finally made it to North Carolina. So, but you better believe the short life cycle of Michael made it a lot more of a challenge in terms of, and coming into it off of a long holiday weekend. It was Columbus Day weekend. So just getting everybody focused and getting everybody's attention, and the speed with which it developed, the rapidity with which it strengthened, is atypical. That's not usual. It was in rapid intensification for almost its entire life cycle.
I know you've got warm water in the Gulf and things like that. Are there theories as to what contributed to that?
No. I think there's opportunities for more research. I do know that in real time, the hurricane season forecasters were kind of marveling over the fact that it continued to not only intensify, but rapidly so, in spite of the fact that there were certain factors that would normally work against that, called wind shear. You know, strong winds aloft up near the jet stream usually tear hurricanes apart, or at least limit their strengthening. But Michael was under the influence of shear, but intensified anyway, right up through landfall. Had the coast been 50 miles further to the north, it would have been that much stronger at landfall.
So when these things get retroactively changed, which you said isn't terribly uncommon,
right?
What's sort of the impact on the research side? And I lack the scientific knowledge to get specific with my question, but what does it kind of do on your end now that this hurricane is historic?
It was already historic, so it's not going to have a huge practical influence or change on anything. The storm was already historic. It was the first time there had ever been anything over Cat 3 at landfall. So a high-end Cat 4 was already historic. It was unprecedented. Now that it's a Cat 5, it's just even that much more so. But no, I think that the areas for focus are on improving our forecast of intensification, the intensity of storms. Very, very good at track forecasting now. Where is it going to go? They got that down pat, and track errors get less and less every year. But it's these rapidly intensifying systems that we're just not there yet. So there more research needs to be put into that. Then the other side of the equation is you could have a perfect forecast, but if people don't take heed, then you're going to have problems. And there are all sorts of reasons that go into why people choose not to evacuate. The biggest one is that they use their prior experience. Well, guess what? No one had ever experienced a hurricane like this in this part of the country. So that was going to fail people. They was like, oh, we survived Opal back in 95, so we're going to be able to handle this. Now, that gets people in trouble. So our challenge as an agency is to try to get folks to personalize and internalize the threat so that they will take action to protect themselves and their family.
Mark, thank you so much for talking to me. Really appreciate your time.
You're very welcome.
That was Capitol reporter Ryan Daly speaking with meteorologist Mark Wohl. As this legislative session hurtles to a close, children's advocates have mixed feelings. A bill that would improve quality in child care providers is poised for passage, but a bid for more funding for early childhood courts is not. Representative Loran Osley, a Tallahassee Democrat long identified with children's issues, is frustrated over some stalled bills. Her measure dealing with the transition from child care to kindergarten hasn't moved. She says Florida should prioritize child care in a manner reflecting its importance, such as helping foster parents cover that cost. Another bill that would boost funding for so-called baby courts serving newborns to three-year-olds isn't moving either.
So I don't mean to be Debbie Downer here, but not a lot positive that I see right now.
Yet Osley and others see some bright spots as well. One is a House bill by freshman Representative Van Salopas, a Miami Republican and leader of the Children's Movement of Florida. That bill would offer professional development to child care providers with the aim of improving quality. It passed the House unanimously and has cleared all its Senate committees. Morgan Evers is a spokeswoman for the Early Learning Coalition of the Big Bend.
A lot of times in the state of Florida, you have a 16-year-old with a GED teaching, which really isn't teaching because they've not been given the proper education to be able to do that. So what we're doing at the Early Learning Coalition is going into these classrooms and raising the bar, and teachers are excited.
Meanwhile, Senate Bill 90, which would increase funding for baby courts, has passed two committees and is in its third and last, but the House companion hasn't been heard. Chief Judge Jonathan Shostrom of the Second Judicial Circuit, which serves the Big Bend, is also the dependency judge. In Leon's early childhood court, he sees 14 families, all the circuit can afford, he says.
I see those families, the kids, almost every single court period, not just the parents, but the kids. And we try to address the entire holistic need of that family to try and take seriously really the constitutional privacy right to parent children by giving those families the resources that they need to put those families back together as soon as we safely can.
Mimi Graham is the director of Florida State University's Center for Prevention and Early Intervention Policy.
We're only serving about 2% of the 12,000 kids under three in Florida that are in the dependency court.
Yet for children ages 0 to 3 in the early childhood courts, The average time from removal to adoption, reunification, or guardianship was 553 days. For kids not in the program, the average time from removal to permanency was 695 days, an increase of more than 25%. Meanwhile, Shostrom says Hurricane Michael has destroyed the regional juvenile detention center in Bay County, so those cases are being heard in Leon.
We in Leon County were so fortunate to dodge that storm, and it's easy to forget how those people are hurting, and the ripples from that disaster, we're seeing them in the court every day.
Osley, too, is focused on responding to the aftermath of Hurricane Michael, and she sees hope in the new chairwoman of the Florida Children and Youth Cabinet.
The fact that Governor DeSantis has put his wife, the First Lady, in charge of the Children's Cabinet, that is a great move. To me, that signals that he is committed to kids, and we are excited about that. And again, there are a number of legislators on both sides of the aisle who have indicated that early learning is a priority. So I hope that bodes well for the future.
'911 operators will directly transfer callers instead of putting them on hold under a bill moving through the Florida Senate. Robbie Gaffney reports the measure follows a report from the Parkland Commission.
This was one of the number one reasons kids weren't communicated with in this tragedy, and one of the biggest lapses, I think.
Plantation Democratic Senator Lauren Book is referencing the communication confusion in the aftermath of the Parkland shooting. It's a major concern to the Parkland Commission, and St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandes took notice.
When you called 911, you weren't getting the 911 for the local police department that oversaw Parkland police and the local police department. And so they were having to transfer calls to the other 911 operator and couldn't directly speak to law enforcement, which delayed in their response.
Brandes is the bill's sponsor. He says the delay was unacceptable.
Got to be able to immediately get on the phone or on the radio and interact with that local law enforcement agency.
The bill is heading for a full floor discussion. I'm Robbie Gaffney.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, a main priority for Florida CFO Jimmy Patronis this session was a bill that would provide some financial relief for Florida firefighters who are diagnosed with cancer. That relief would take the form of a one-time cash payout of $25,000 upon initial diagnosis. For a while, it appeared that bill would go down in flames, but now seems likely to make it through the process. Capitol reporter Blaise Ganey sat down with CFO Patronis.
All right, I'm here with Chief Financial Officer Jimmy Patronis. He's been pushing an initiative to provide financial relief for firefighters across the state that are diagnosed with cancer. This is after studies show they are 68% more likely to develop the disease. The bill made it to the seventh week of session without being heard, but after House Speaker Jose Oliva said the legislation would move, it did just that. It's now heading to the floor after passing the State Affairs Committee. The Senate bill is also on the floor. Jimmy, talk about what this means for firefighters across Florida now that this bill is nearing full passage.
Sure. So our firefighters, they're heroes in my mind. They work 24/7, 365. They are the constant safety net behind every one of our communities. And as they have had our backs all this time, it was time for the Florida legislature for us to stand united and show that we had their backs. So today was a good day in the Florida House.
They also added an amendment on the bill. I believe now volunteer firefighters and part-time firefighters will also be included on that.
Again, I think when the legislature embraces and adding benefits, there'll be some local governments will need to be able to figure out how to bring that policy in for line. So, look, I think as they can cover all different levels of service when it comes to the fire services, that's not just good for the profession. It's good for recruitment. It helps people realize that this is a profession that can go in that is going to give them peace of mind, that the profession is going to protect them, and also give their family comfort that their loved one has some peace of mind and safety. I don't like fixing problems. I like preventing problems. And the decontamination kits with the partnership with the University of Miami's Sylvester Institute is changing the approach of cleanliness towards after the fire has been extinguished and how we treat their bunker gear and how they get back in the cabs and how they get back into their fire station where they, you know, live and spend sometimes more time there than with their own families. So we've got to create a cleanliness culture, and that's exactly what the decontamination buckets do. What this bill does here is going to ensure that, heaven forbid, they're diagnosed with cancer, that we've got a plan, an action plan in place to help them treat it and ensure that they're not left financially ruined because of it.
And so this is the state saying, hey, we're going to help out. On the county, like Palm Beach County, they did it on their own.
Right.
Will this fund those small rural counties maybe do the same?
Well, and it really depends on where their relationship is with the state retirement system. Almost all counties, all 67 counties are part of it. But some firefighters, what are called local plans that are municipal plans, those will be something they'll have to deal with at the local level. But if you're a member of FRS, there's some benefits that tie into this particular legislation.
Have you heard from those like local municipality groups about where they are on providing these same benefits?
So the League of Cities definitely had some hesitation on this, but this is no different than last year with the PTSD legislation. In my opinion, the League of Cities was dead wrong. And at the end of the day, we proposed and passed legislation that complemented our firefighters. Hats off to Mayor Lenny Curry last year. You know, he came out, was a strong advocate for our PTSD legislation. As I've talked to Mayor Jimenez of Miami-Dade County, he's come out, he's been a strong advocate for not just the PTSD, but also the cancer benefit legislation. So we do have mayors out there that are leading the charge at the municipal level. But all collectively work together, what's in the past, we're going to move forward with good policy to protect our firefighters.
And these firefighters, does this bill provide any relief for their families also?
Well, again, when you are diagnosed with cancer, there's usually a pretty substantial deductible that goes along with it. Every time that there's an out-of-pocket expense from a household to treat cancer, it affects the whole ability of the household to function. So this benefit will ultimately help keep the household financially solvent.
All right. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Sure. Thanks. Appreciate it, Blaise.
That's Capitol reporter Blaise Gainey speaking with Florida Chief Financial Officer Jimmy Patronis. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Gainey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. Thanks also to Robbie Gaffney. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again every weeknight throughout the Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag.